not ask, and I will not ask for the men who give the reports to put in the report, is what did you learn at the feast? What did you come away with? Visibly, I came away with only one thing from the feast in New Braunfels, and that was a green stain on my finger that came from a freshly fallen new pecan. While my wife and Jeff and I were standing looking at this huge tree, and I didn't recognize it immediately, but it was in an arboretum, and we're looking at the signs, and this one didn't have a sign. I looked up at the tree and thinking, what is that? And all of a sudden, boom, and Judy says, well, whatever it is, it's dropping nuts. So she picked it up, and we looked at it, and it was huge. It was a big pecan. So we recognized, of course, that it was a pecan tree, but we both picked it up, and of course, the green stain passes on to your hand, and hers seemed to disappear a lot quicker than mine. I think I've still got a little smudge there, but since I'm colorblind, I pretend it's not there and everything's fine. But we did enjoy a little trip through the New Braunfels park and arboretum after everyone had left the site. But what did you learn? What did you take away? Several of the sermons and Bible studies and things in New Braunfels, guys would say, well, what's the takeaway? Or what am I trying to give you to take home? And then they would give us their major point. When we go to the feast, of course, there is expected to be some kind of takeaway. It's not just to be there, though being there is important. Being there, in fact, is primary because God commands us to be there. But once we're there, we take away not only the extra weight that may have to cause us to have our suit sizes changed. I'm a bit in that position myself. I'm going to try to change it the other way. Instead of changing the suit, I'm going to try to change me. But that's a pretty hard job. It'd be a lot easier to get the suit adjusted. But we come away with something besides the weight that we gain. We come away, we hope, with some experience that will help us continue to serve God in a meaningful and proper way. We come away maybe with a specific lesson that we learned through something was said. I thought it was interesting. Mr. Horchak, on his last day in the last sermon of the feast, made the comment in thanking everybody for their messages and all that. He said, it's interesting how you could go to the feast over and over and still learn something. He said, I learned several things this year just from the way things were presented or some kind of expression that was used or a certain experience or lesson that was given. I'm not quoting him, but that was the way he was phrasing it or framing it, was that he learned some things being at the feast this year. Of course, he's been coming to the feast since he was a teenager. So we all, I think, feel that way from time to time. I've certainly learned some things at almost every feast I've been to, I think. And you certainly learn by being there and participating fully. And sometimes then you're able to pass those things that you learned on to others. I gave one Bible study at the Feast of New Braunfels, and quite a number of people over the next few days made a comment on one specific point that I had made. And I knew at the time that it wasn't something everybody hears very often, but didn't know if it would sink in. But it did sink in, and it was nice that people were able to come and say, you know, I don't think I'd ever heard that before, and I appreciated hearing it. It wasn't new truth. It was just an observation. It was a way of looking at something that the Scripture says. So we sometimes have the opportunity to pass on what we learn and what we pick up. But we should come home with something. And if you haven't already done that, and that is, if you don't feel like you have come home with something, then you probably need to review your feast. Not only these feast reports, but a personal review of what you did, what you experienced, what was the most exciting, what was the most satisfying, what was the most helpful, what was the most meaningful. What kind of experiences did you have with fellowship with others in terms of their stories, their lessons? I was reading something in Time magazine a couple of days ago in which an author, and I can't remember what it was or why, it was just a little interview, but she said, I have noticed, maybe it was a Hollywood person, she said, I have noticed that when I say to a couple, how did you people meet, how did you two meet, that everybody around the table suddenly is paying attention because we love to hear people's stories and we love to hear people's relationships. And she said, that's all you have to say is, how did you two meet? And everybody wants to listen. Everybody wants to hear. The table stops talking, and people want to hear that couple tell you how they met. And it's true in terms of at the feast, how did you come into the church? When did you come into the church? What was your specific provocation that brought you to the knowledge of the truth, whatever it might be. And we enjoy hearing those stories. And, of course, from time to time, we also enjoy telling them. I told a little bit of our story in the 1963 context of Jekyll Island, a little bit of our story, Judy and me, and one or two older ladies said to me later, really appreciate you telling your personal stories. And sometimes those personal stories have an impact. So what did you hear? What did you share? What did you learn? What did you participate in that made a difference in terms of your feet? It can certainly be the whole picture. Sometimes it's not one thing. Maybe you can't even isolate one thing. Maybe it's, as Dr. Erickson was saying, it's the beautiful beach, it's the restaurants that are there, it's the fellowship, it's sitting on the balcony having brunch. It's all of these things that come together, and of course then hopefully that includes the feast services and the messages and the lessons that you learn there, along with the various organized fellowship times such as family dances or concerts or fun shows or seniors' lunches, things of that sort. I hope you are able to go back and think about things that made a difference for you. And even if there wasn't anything dramatic, to be able to say, what did I learn and what can I do with it as we leave the feast and start forward in our fall and winter time before we come to another feast. Let's go back to Deuteronomy chapter 14. Going to refer only briefly to this because we will probably have a sermon in the near future about this entire concept, because we must all now start looking forward to next year, making the plans for next year. But in Deuteronomy 14, verse 22, God told Israel, "You shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain that the field produces year by year. And you shall eat before the Eternal your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide." And again, we've come to understand that God doesn't just kind of roll the dice and say, okay, we're going to go to New Braunfels or we're going to go to Orange Beach. He allows us to look and see what's available and where it is. And once the choice is made, we are quite sure that God then puts his presence in those feast sites. And I think most of us have seen the evidence of that. In the place where he chooses to make his name abide, the tithe of your grain, your new wine, and your oil, of the firstborn of your herds and your flocks, that you may learn to fear the Eternal your God always. Notice the overview and the overall purpose is that you may learn to fear the Eternal your God always. Now, I confess to those of you who were in the New Braunfels, because there are many here who were anyway, this was the theme and the subject of my sermon on the Sabbath. But as we leave the feast and go forward, I think it's important to look back and say, well, if God says go to the feast and learn to fear me always, then we look and say, okay, did I learn anything about fearing God? And again, I have to define fear here. It's not the terror and the fear of trouble and problems and calamity, but rather the worship and the awe and the respect and the reverence we pay to God. Because in this context, in many other contexts in the Scriptures, that's what it means. Subtle differences in the words, but for the most part, even the same word is sometimes translated to be the terrorizing kind of fear, and other places it's translated to mean the respect and reverence kind of fear. So here it is referring to coming to worship God, to respect God, to reverence God, to fear God. In other words, we come to the Feast of Tabernacles partly to learn to know God and to appreciate God and to worship God. And so when he says, come and do this that you may learn to fear God, then we should probably take stock, as I'm asking us to do today, after the feast is over, and say, what did we learn? Again, maybe you could put down specific things, or maybe you can simply put down the impression. Maybe the impression is just, God is really good. God is really kind. God is really merciful. God is really powerful. Even to travel, as Brandon and Rosalind did, across the world and see brethren, people who you can go in and be among and be comfortable with, though you've never seen them before in your life, and to know that God is present, and it's obvious that God's Spirit is there. It's an amazing experience. I've done it in many countries around the world, and it's an amazing feeling to know that you're among brethren, even though you can't speak the same language. In some cases, you can in Fiji, but you can in some cases even speak the same language. But you can sing the same hymns, and you can smile and shake hands and try to make some kind of conversation with each other, and you feel at home. You feel like you're among God's people. Just to know that you're within the church of God, that you are among God's people, that God is doing an amazing thing on the earth, that God is bringing a people out of the world, calling them His own, not only bringing them to a feast site and setting them apart to do something nobody else does, but bringing them out of the world and setting them apart to be His special, peculiar people to become His household. It's an amazing and wonderful thing. So coming to the Feast of Tabernacles, maybe not quite as dramatically today as it was in 1963. I say that having done both. The feast is still an exciting and wonderful and helpful and educational time for us. But it was kind of overwhelming in those days, as Mr. Frank said, to have 1,600 people that had never been to the feast before all descend on one site. That's an amazing feeling. To start talking to people and finding out that they're just learning the truth, that they're just coming to the knowledge of God's way, that they're there because they're so excited about the truth. We don't have that in the church today because we have very little new growth, but it's coming and it will come. But in the meantime, we need to learn and grow with the conditions we have. It's a different set of conditions. And I, for one, can say I would learn and grow, and hopefully did learn and grow more in this feast in different ways than I would have in 1963 as a newcomer. So we have to look at it and say, God says, come and rejoice before me and learn to fear me. Eat the tithe that you have carefully saved and set aside for that purpose, and recognize that God knows what He's doing, and God's in charge, and God's powerful, God is good, God is loving, God is merciful, and that God has a plan of salvation for all of mankind, which we rehearse every year, and we know that plan. We can lay it out. We can lay out the holy days and summarize the meaning of each of them. Almost everybody in this room, even down to some of the smaller children, can do that. We can lay out the feast plan. We can lay out the plan of salvation. We can talk about why we're here. We can talk about what God's going to do in the millennium and what He's going to do in the white throne judgment. And yet God says, come before me year in and year out. Year by year, it says right here in this very verse. Do it year by year and come before me. And so we come to worship and serve God and learn to fear God. And He tells us how to do that. And interesting, God tells us to come and learn to worship Him by what? By spending the money to rejoice in the things that we want to do. Things that we want to do within His law. Things that we want to do within His purpose and His plan. Not going off and going out into the world and creating some kind of a sinful lifestyle for a week, as frankly some of the world does when they celebrate the religious holidays. Anything goes. No, but rather to go and worship God by diligently keeping His law and following His way and accepting His goodness to tell us, come before me and eat and drink and enjoy life. Enjoy it. Most of us did. But then learn from that enjoyment. What do you learn from that enjoyment? You learn that God is the source of enjoyment. You learn that God is the source of satisfaction. That God is the source of good things. That God is the protector and defender of His people. And so we learn to fear God. We learn to worship God. We learn to appreciate God. Let me go on, but if the journey is too long for you so that you're not able to carry the tithe, or the place where the Eternal Your God chooses to put His name is too far from you, when the Eternal Your God has blessed you, then you shall exchange it for money. So He's not expecting that you necessarily take what you have produced in your crops. In our cases, of course, that's almost irrelevant today. Very few of us in the church even make our living from the crops. We get a paycheck of some sort, or even the farmers generally have to pay themselves a salary and figure out their profit and loss at the end of the year and all of that. So in most cases, it's already been turned into money for us. That's not so much the point here as to what He says to do with it. So He says, exchange it for money, take the money in your hand, and go to the place which Eternal Your God chooses, and you shall spend that money for whatever your heart desires. King James says, whatever your soul lusts after. And of course, that would contradict the commandment. So it's not a proper translation. The proper translation is what you earnestly desire. Spend that money for whatever you earnestly desire. In what context? For sheep. for oxen, for wine, or similar drink, for whatever your heart desires. In other words, live well on whatever you have available for you for that period of time. Now, of course, some people can live far better than others, because some people live far better than others throughout the year. And the tithe is a proper measurement in the sense that if I'm living on a very small income, my tithe is going to be small, but it's still going to be focused on an eight-day period in which I can spend more than I can the rest of the year. If I have more money than I know what to do with, then spending that tithe becomes a little more elaborate, a little more opulent, perhaps. Maybe I live in a very, very nice place at the feast and eat very nice meals and maybe have other services available that we never would be able to do the rest of the year. Whatever it is, God says, go and enjoy it, eat, drink, be merry in that sense. But not eat, drink, and be merry because tomorrow we die. No, eat, drink, and be merry to prove that God has given you blessings and that God wants you to remember that He is the source of your blessings. You shall eat there before the Eternal your God. So we're not just eating at the feast, we're eating before God. That is, we are thanking God for what we have, we're celebrating with God, we're worshiping God in the process of enjoying the physical things that the five senses can enjoy. We're human beings. God didn't tell us to go there and sit in the corner and meditate and rejoice. He told us to go and eat and drink and rejoice. In the next line, eat there before the Eternal your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household. So the rejoicing itself, the satisfying of the five senses, as it were, along with, of course, the intellect and the mental, spiritual desires that come when you sit down to listen to a good message. And in one sense, almost any message at the feast is going to be a good message, depending on your frame of mind at the moment, and it's probably going to have something for you. But he says, rejoice before God. He wants us to rejoice with Him. He wants us to celebrate with Him. You know how you like to go out with friends with whom you always have a good time? You know how you like to go to dinner with people who are always good company? Or you like to go have a beer with somebody who just is really good to talk to? God is saying, come and eat and drink and rejoice with me. I want to be with you. I want you to be with me. And I want you to go home feeling like this was a good time. I think I'll go back and be with God again. Not just at the feast, but day in and day out, Sabbath in and Sabbath out as the year goes by. So we have a command before we go to the feast, not just to go and spend the money, but to go and rejoice and to go and learn to fear God. So when we come home from the feast, it seems only fair that we ask ourselves, how did we do? You know, we kind of call it, if we're taking an official poll, we call it feedback or, a survey of some sort. We call it analyzing the activity, trying to determine what went well and what didn't. You know, we deconstruct the thing that we did and we say, what worked and what didn't? How can we do this better next year? Now, I'm not suggesting you sit down and make a big list on paper of, I had these things worked and these things didn't work. I'm going to eliminate all of these things. And I'm going to add to these things. I'm simply saying, consider the experience. Think about where we've been, what we've done, and what it should have done for us, and ask ourselves, did it? Did I come home with a deeper appreciation of God? Did I come home with a little better understanding of God's plan of salvation? Even if I know the details, did I come home with ability to maybe see it and perceive it and in my mind's eye understand it a little bit better than I did before I went? Did I enjoy my time with God and God's people? Was I able to rejoice? Was I able to learn a little bit about how to fear God? And of course, that does not just include the eating and the drinking. It includes the spiritual instruction and guidance and fellowship and all of those things as well. In Nehemiah chapter 8, we sometimes go here in preparation for the feast. I don't believe we did this year in this congregation. I think we can learn something from this, however, even in arrears. Nehemiah chapter 8. Notice verse 1 starts with, when the seventh month came, the children of Israel were in their city. Sorry, that's probably the end of the previous verse. My Bible breaks it up. When the seventh month came, the children of Israel were in their city. So we're talking about the seventh month, which is the month of trumpets, atonement, tabernacles, and the last great day. Drop down to verse 8. Mentions the Levites and the whole list of the ministry, in that sense, the priesthood who were present in verse 7, and then says in verse 8, so they read distinctly from the book and the law of God, and they gave the sense and helped them to understand the reading. Now, this actually happened after they had found that the book said you should do certain things, and now they find other things because they're looking and reading. But notice, they read and they gave the sense. In other words, the priesthood read the scriptures and then explained what they meant. So give them understanding. Help them understand the reading, it says. And Nehemiah, who was the governor, Ezra the priest and scribe, and the Levites who taught the people, said to all the people, this day is holy to the eternal your God. Do not mourn nor weep. For all the people wept when they heard the words of the law. You see what I'm talking about when I say maybe the feast today isn't quite the emotional experience that it might have been for so many in 1963 or 1965 or whenever the church was growing so rapidly. These people were rediscovering God and God's law. And it says they wept when they heard of the law. Then he said to them, go your way, eat the fat, drink the sweet, send portions to those for whom nothing is prepared, for this day is holy to our Lord. Do not sorrow, for the joy of the eternal is your strength. So the Levites quieted all the people, saying, be still, for the day is holy, do not be grieved. And all the people went their way to eat and drink, to send portions, to rejoice greatly, because they understood the words that were declared to them. Can you rejoice in the feast when you understand the words that are said? And you say, I've heard all this before. You know, you can listen to a sermon that's carefully and thoroughly, and maybe very interestingly, explaining how God is carrying out his plan. But you can say, you know, I've heard this all before. Well, there were several people in New Braunfels who had been at the feast for over 60 years. I think 63 was the top figure. But 60 plus years. Still coming to the feast, still listening to the messages, still coming up sometimes to the ministry and saying, thank you for that message. I really appreciate that. I got a lot out of it. You know, can we rejoice before God because we understand? Because God has to give us that understanding. We don't have it of and by ourselves. Verse 13. Now on the second day of the second day, the heads of the fathers' houses of all the peoples with the priests and Levites were gathered to Ezra the scribe in order to understand the words of the law. So they wanted to hear more. And they found written in the law, which the Eternal had commanded by Moses, that the children of Israel should dwell in booths during the feast of the seventh month. They're supposed to dwell in booths. Get out of their houses, throw up a lean-to of sorts made with palm branches and other trees, and stay in that. Verse 15, and that they should announce and proclaim in all their cities and in Jerusalem, saying, go out to the mountain and bring olive branches of oil trees, myrtle branches, palm branches, and branches of leafy trees to make booths as it is written. And so they went out and did it. They went out and built the booths, and they kept the feast. The final part of this chapter says, in the last part of verse 18, let's read all of verse 18. Verse 18, also day by day, from the first day until the last day, he read from the book of the law of God, and they kept the feast 7 days. And on the eighth day, there was a sacred assembly according to the prescribed manner. So as they learned, they applied. And when they applied, they rejoiced. They celebrated. They were very, very pleased and thankful to be able to know God's law. They learned as they kept the feast. You and I keep the feast in order to learn by doing. Yes, we're taught. Yes, we're instructed. But we learn by being there. We learn by coming before God every day and saying, God, I'm here. Teach me. God, I'm here. I'm alert. I'm paying attention. I want to be here. I want to hear what your servants have to say. I want to know what the message is for today. That's the attitude in which we should try to arrive at services on a daily basis. Now, you and I have kept the feast. Virtually everybody, if not every last person, but I think virtually everybody in here in one way or another has kept the feast. So let's go to Deuteronomy chapter 26. Oops. Deuteronomy chapter 26. Sorry, for those of you who heard that little loose slip out, I should explain. I was thinking I was in, still in Deuteronomy 14, so I started to go right to find Deuteronomy 26, and then realized I was in Nehemiah, and I said, oops, but it reminded me of the old question in the cartoon when the patient is looking at the surgeon, he says, what do you mean when you say oops? Well, lest you think I meant something more than that, I simply was going the wrong way in my Bible. Not nearly as critical, probably, when the ministry says oops, as it is when the surgeon is bending over your open abdomen. What do you mean when you say oops? That's a pretty good question. Deuteronomy 26. Again, breaking in here to the discussion of the feast, verse 11. So you shall rejoice in every good thing which the Eternal your God has given to you and your house, you and the Levite and the stranger who's among you. Now he's talking about taking care of the needy. When you have finished laying aside all the tithe of the increase in the third year, the year of tithing, so we're not talking specifically here about the feast, but about being able to set aside the help to the needy that Israel had to do in the third tithe, mostly covered in our day and age by Social Security and welfare and other things, taxes, though we still maintain, of course, an emergency fund and an assistance fund for brethren who are needy in the church. When you finish laying aside all the tithe of your increase, in other words, you've done what you're supposed to do, the year of tithing, and have given it to the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, so that they may eat within your gates and be filled. You have done your part to take care of those whom God tells you to take care of. Notice what he says in verse 13. Then you shall say before the Eternal your God, I have removed the holy tithe from my house, and also have given them to the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, according to all your commandments which you have commanded me. I have not transgressed your commandments, nor have I forgotten them. This is a specific situation about the third tithe in Israel, which was the fund set aside for the widows, the fatherless, the needy, the stranger, the Levite. So he says, I have done all of that so that they can eat within your gates and be filled. Verse 13, then you shall say before the Eternal your God, I have removed, sorry, I read that. Verse 14, I have not eaten any of it when in mourning, nor have I removed any of it for an unclean use, nor given any of it for the dead. So it was supposed to be carefully guarded and managed. I have obeyed the voice of the Eternal my God and have done according to all that you commanded me. That's the key line right there. I have obeyed the voice of my God and have done all according to all that you have commanded me. Look down from your holy habitation. Now I'm going to suggest, brethren, that we can do this now. We have kept the feast. We have laid aside the funds. We have gone and kept the feast. We have come before God in the days he commanded. We have worshipped him as he told us to worship him. We should be able now with faith and confidence to come before God and say, I have done what you commanded me. Look down from your holy habitation, from heaven, and bless your people Israel and the land which you have given us, just as you swore to our fathers, a land flowing with milk and honey. In other words, the brethren are claiming God's goodness. They're claiming God's promise. In this case, it's Israel. But we can do that on a spiritual level today. We are the spiritual Israel. We are God's house. We are God's holy nation. And we can come before God and say, God, we've done what you told us to do. Now, even if we can't quite figure out what we learned, maybe, or exactly what was the most exciting experience, doesn't matter. If we recognize that we've done everything we can to go and serve God and keep the feast, then there's nothing wrong with us coming before God and saying, as they did here, he wouldn't have written it down otherwise, quoted it, Lord, look down from your holy habitation from heaven and bless your people Israel and the land which you have given us, just as you swore to our fathers, a land flowing with milk and honey. There aren't very many people in this world genuinely keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. Now you find all kinds of little groups and sometimes break off splinter groups that came to the truth through the church, but sometimes you even find people who have simply discovered some of it in the scriptures, or they have some kind of tradition. There was a little group about 20 miles away from us up in San Marcos, and somebody went up there to either go to Outlet Mall or whatever and was in a place and discovered that there was a Feast of Tabernacles site in San Marcos. And so they went over. If you know about this, I'd be interested in hearing, but they went over to check it out, and it turned out it was a group of people all wearing turbans of some sort or some kind of Middle Eastern dress, and were not very welcoming at all. and didn't want to talk about their Feast of Tabernacles, so I didn't get a whole lot of information, but they claim to be keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. Whether they keep the Feast of Tabernacles like we believe God intends that we keep it, and how we keep it, it probably remains to be seen, but I doubt that that's what they're doing. There are little groups here and there, though. I used to see a guy on TV about this time of the year. It wasn't during the feast, but about this time of the year, he would have a 3 or 4 day television series that he called the Feast of Tabernacles. And all he would do is go to the scripture and talk about the feast and then try to come draw some spiritual lessons from it. Maybe the kind of thing we're talking about today, but without keeping the feast. But obviously there are lots of groups of the Church of God that almost entirely have come from the same source of the knowledge of the feast that was gained way back in the 20s and 30s, who keep the feast in various places today. We had several of them around in various cities, even next to our own feast sites. My point is, we've done what God commands us to do. We can say to God, we left our jobs, we left our school, we left in some cases an irate family member behind. We went off and kept the Feast of Tabernacles. We set it aside, recognized that it was holy to you. We worshiped and served you, and you have the power to acknowledge that by looking down upon us and saying, I'm going to bless you for that. Now, we didn't do it in order to obtain that blessing per se, but in learning to fear God, we learned to appreciate that God is a generous God who does bless. So there's nothing wrong with claiming that blessing, either in terms of how it affects your job or how it affects your children's grades at school or how it affects your thinking and your mental processes. All of that is something we should do after the feast to consider where we've been and what we've done. My wife and I have been thanking God for the feast and our prayers all week long. We continue to have the residual benefits of having been in God's presence day in and day out and learning the truth that God intended that we learn. Same principles expressed in a different form in Malachi chapter 3. We're talking here about our response to God's instruction and God's command. Even as Israel there in returning to the promised land after the captivity discovered the law and rejoiced in trying to respond to God's instruction, so we, having been instructed and given the knowledge of the feast days, and our responsibilities before God, should also rejoice before God and let God bless us in the way that he did then. Malachi chapter 3. Again, this is the context of tithing, but notice the principle we're looking for here. Chapter 3, verse 10. Bring all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house, and try me now in this. Try me. God says, prove me. Try me. Check it out. See if I won't do what I said. Try me now in this, says the Eternal of Hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such a blessing that there will not be room enough to receive it. See, God says, take me to relying on this. Do what I've instructed you to do. And in this case, it's about tithing. But the point is, when we obey God, when we respond to God's instruction, we also have the privilege of going to God and saying, I have done what you commanded me to do, and I would appreciate the blessing that I happen to be in considerable need of at this point in time. I wrote down number of scriptures that just acknowledge that God is the source of all this. I'm only going to read one in closing here in Psalm 119. Psalm 119, beginning in verse 67. Let me change that, sorry. I'm going to read two sections for you. Psalm 138. Psalm 138. I don't want to overlook this one. I was going to skip it. Second thought, I want to read it. Psalm 138, beginning in verse 1. Oh, give thanks to the Eternal, for he is good, for his mercy endures forever. Oh, give thanks to the God of gods, for his mercy endures forever. We sing some of these things. All give thanks to the eternal of lords, or the God of lords, the Lord of lords, for his mercy endures forever. To him who alone does great wonders, for his mercy endures forever. To him who by wisdom made the heavens, for his mercy endures forever. You see, the point here of the worship is that God is a God of mercy. He's a God that's so great that he does all of these things, and yet he has time to have mercy on us. To him who laid out the earth above the waters. See, when we go to the Feast of Tabernacles to worship God, we learn that he is the God who does all of these things. For his mercy endures forever. To him who made great lights, meaning the sun, the moon, the stars. For his mercy endures forever. The sun to rule by day. For his mercy endures forever. The moon and stars to rule by night. For his mercy endures forever. To him who struck Egypt in their firstborn. For his mercy endures forever. And brought out Israel from among them. With a strong hand, verse 12. God has done miraculous and wonderful things in ancient Israel. And we talk about those a lot when we read the history of Israel. But he's done great things in his church today. He will continue to do great things in his church today. Let's go back to Psalm 119 now. As I mentioned before, will be the final scripture, Psalm 119, verse 57. Lots of verses here we could read. It's a very long psalm. We're going to start in verse 57. This is something we should have learned. This is something we should know. This is part of coming away from the feast, having eaten and drunk and enjoyed time and opportunities and privileges and fellowship, inspiration. Verse 57, you are my portion, O Eternal. I have said that I would keep your words. That's why we were there. I entreated your favor with my whole heart. Be merciful to me according to your word. I thought about my ways and turned my feet to your testimonies. I made haste and did not delay to keep your commandments. The cords of the wicked have bound me, but I have not forgotten your law. At midnight I will rise to give thanks to you because of your righteous judgments. I am a companion of all who fear you. Something we learned at the feast. I am a companion of all who fear you and of those who keep your precepts. The earth, O Eternal, is full of your mercy. Teach me your statutes. So God has called us to his church. He's called us to his feast. He's given us the opportunity to rejoice before him, to actually enjoy the abundance of life and of our blessings of this nation for an entire week together, fellowshipping with him, fellowshipping with our brethren, learning and growing and coming away with, in a sense, something to carry in our bosom for the next few months as we face the changing weather, the changing seasons, the dearth of holy days, not having another one now until the spring. God's given us something to go on, and we should rejoice before God and claim God's promises and look for God to bless us both intellectually, spiritually, and physically for the time to come. I hope you had a great feast, and I look forward to hearing some of your stories that were not yet reported.